This is Joan with the Bloomington Normal Pantograph, dated Thursday, April 11th, 2019. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Ready to Plant, Farmers Hoping for Dry Weather. Cold, wet start to spring has many in a waiting game. By Kevin Barlow. Bloomington. As central Illinois farmers grow increasingly anxious to get their planters in the fields, experts say it is too early to get nervous. April 15th is traditionally kind of a target date to start planting corn, said Jason Carr, a technology development representative with Bayer Crop Science in Bloomington. We're not quite there yet, but the weather gets nice and farmers want to get into the fields as quickly as possible. It's just been too wet to do anything yet. The United States Department of Agriculture estimates Illinois farmers will plant 11.2 million acres of corn in 2019, an increase of about 2% over last year. Farmers are expected to plant 10.5 million acres of soybeans, a drop of about 3% from 2018. I know the farmers are anxious to get going, said Mike Orso, Director of News and Communication for the Illinois Farm Bureau, based in Bloomington. But we have had precipitation on almost a weekly basis since December. It's been cold and wet since then, and that doesn't look to change anytime soon. Showers are possible Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday, said Heather Stanley, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Lincoln, meaning farm equipment will remain parked. The ground is still very wet, she noted. More rain is on the way, which will keep the fields wet. Brian Leffler, whose farm east of Stanford is bustling with activity preparing for planting, wants to get into the fields sometime in the next 5 to 10 days, he said. The conditions have just been too wet to do much of anything, he said. Leffler, who farms numerous fields from Stanford to Lexington, is using the time to fine-tune a seed tender and a massive 24-row planter. There's a lot of fields that look like they've actually been plowed this spring, but that's not the case, he said. They were actually plowed last fall. Leffler said it will take some sunshine and wind to dry out the field so they can be prepared for planting. Fred Greeter, a corn and soybean farmer near Carlock and president of the Bloomington-based McLean County Farm Bureau, also is waiting for dry weather. I would say we are about 7 to 10 days away from getting in the fields, he said. We didn't get some of the field work we would normally do in the fall because we had an early start to the winter. We had a cold spell with snow in November, and that prevented us from getting much work done at that point. Dan Pattern, a certified crop advisor with First Mid-Ag Services of Bloomington, said he has heard similar stories from several farmers. When you get snow in early November, the hope is that you can get into the fields early in the spring to finish that work, he said. It's still early and not a lot of cause for concern yet, but everyone would like to have some dry, warmer weather. Statewide, March was colder and substantially wetter than the average March, according to the Illinois State Water Survey. The average statewide March temperature was 36.6 degrees, which is 4.7 degrees below average. The average precipitation was 4.16 inches, which was 1.2 inches above the long-term average. That's been the theme of the whole spring so far, wet and cold, said Tim Stock, executive vice president of the Macon County Farm Bureau. The only thing farmers can do is to prepare their equipment for planting and maybe fine-tune their plans a little bit, but it's mostly a waiting game. Orso said that once the weather does turn dry, it won't take farmers long to get busy. I always think it is amazing how fast corn and soybeans get planted, he said. Almost every year we have concerns about the weather, but every year they get the crop in the ground, and sooner or later they will. The forecast for the rest of April looks somewhat promising. After weekend showers, dry weather is expected for the remainder of next week, with slowly warming temperatures, Stanley said. At least one field is planted in Woodford County. Card said Bayer Crop Science planted a field near Roanoke on Tuesday. It's not what I would recommend, he said, but we wanted to run a few experiments and tests to see how the seed would respond to some different treatments. It won't help us much this year, but the research will help us in the future. The next story is headlined, Grandin Praises Value of Misfits. Author's Speech Draws Crowd at ISU. By Lenore Sabota. Normal. We need the weird people, the people who think differently, noted animal behaviorist, author, and woman with autism, Temple Grandin, told a standing-room-only crowd Wednesday at Illinois State University. The geeks and the misfits build stuff, said Grandin, delivering the keynote address for Science and Technology Week. The world needs all kinds of minds. Pointing to innovators such as Thomas Edison, Steve Jobs, and the Wright brothers, she questioned whether those tagged with labels today could succeed as they did. Grandin, author of Emergence, Labeled Autistic, and Animals Make Us Human, is often considered to be the most accomplished and well-known adult with autism in the world. A professor of animal science at Colorado State University with a doctoral degree from the University of Illinois, she has designed cattle handling facilities for Cargill and others. Autism is an important part of who I am, but it's secondary to the livestock industry, Grandin told her audience in the Brown Ballroom at Bone Student Center, Normal. Describing herself as a visual thinker, one who thinks in pictures, Grandin said that even if she could wave a magic wand to erase her autism, she wouldn't. I like the logical way I think. I loved Mr. Spock in Star Trek, she said. When I was a kid in high school, a lot of kids bullied and teased me, she said. What saved her was having shared interests with others, such as horses and building model rockets. People often ask me what helped me, said Grandin. First of all, it was my mother. She knew how to stretch me beyond my comfort zone. Grandin is concerned that too many kids with labels get babied today. Instead, they should be eased out of their comfort zone, as her mother did with her, and should take on jobs, whether it's walking dogs or mowing lawns, until they are old enough for other jobs. The common denominators in successful minds include learning how to work, being surrounded by books, and having mentors, she said. Her advice for working with people who think differently was, do not overload working memory, provide choices of activities, limit screen time, stretch them slightly out of their comfort zone. The best way to change perceptions about autism is to get out there and prove the things you can do, she said. Schools also need to retain or bring back hands-on classes such as art, sewing, woodworking, and welding, she said. Grandin also said children need to be exposed to more career options, including skilled trades such as plumbing and electrical work, to find what they like. High-end skilled trades aren't going to be replaced by artificial intelligence, she said. Grandin spoke for nearly an hour on topics ranging from autism and different kinds of thinking to the agriculture industry and animal handling. She then answered questions for about 20 minutes and signed books afterward. People were turned away after the ballroom filled to its 1,000-person capacity. Some listened in the hallway. The crowd, which gave her a standing ovation at the end, applauded numerous times. The loudest applause came when she said, putting computers in the schools doesn't make schools wonderful. Good teachers make the schools wonderful. Speaking of agriculture, Grandin said, the hardest thing for me was being a woman in a man's industry, not having autism. Her own visual thinking enabled her to see that cattle were scared by things like sunbeams, loose chains hanging down, or even a misplaced paper towel. It helped her to design cattle handling facilities used across the world. The next story is entitled, Director Buyout Draws Criticism, by Kelsey Watznauer. Normal. The recent resignation of McLean County Unit 5's Human Resources Director drew a crowd, and three people signed up to speak at Wednesday's school board meeting. The board voted unanimously in March to approve a resignation agreement for James Harden, former Director of Human Resources and Student Services. The agreement was listed among several personnel changes. Since then, allegations of harassment have come to light in connection with the resignation. While members of the public criticized how the district handled the matter or asked for clarification, board members and district officials did not comment Wednesday night. I think Unit 5 has a long history of not knowing how to address bullying and harassment, Jody Slothauer, who identified herself as a parent of a student who had been bullied, told the board. This is evident to me since clearly your most recent director in charge of human resources, according to material that was available through FOIA, was harassing and bullying people for about 2 years, she said. Unit 5 was aware of this behavior but did not fire him for 2 years. How can a superintendent or the school board ask students, teachers, and staff, how can you ask anyone not to harass anyone, not to bully anyone, if you, all of you, cannot stand up against a person who behaves this way? The allegations, which district officials have not commented on, include reported statements involving race and sexual situations. There were so many different rumors going about, and some of the allegations seem so absolutely ridiculous. We just need to get the information out, said Jerry James, political action chairman of the local NAACP chapter, after he spoke to the board. When asked for more information about Hardin's resignation last week, Superintendent Mark Daniel declined to comment, stating only, "It is a personnel issue." Speaking first during public comments, Melinda White defended Hardin. "Every charge against Dr. Hardin was an all-out lie, which led to a false conclusion," she said. She spoke highly of his character, calling any claims to the contrary vicious lies and rumors. After the public comment period at the meeting at Normal Community West High School, the board voted to approve bids for 3 building operations projects. Henson Robinson Company was chosen to replace 2 boilers and 2 rooftop units, which control heating and cooling, and to cut and remove 16 feet of driveway and sidewalk on the west side of Kingsley Junior High School. The project is estimated to cost $384,827. TCI Companies Incorporated was selected to install a geothermal bore field at Kingsley for $419,000 as part of the district's energy efficiency projects. H.J. Eppel and Company Incorporated secured the bid for the Parkside Junior High School resurfacing project, in which 3 areas will be repaved. This contractor was the low bidder at $194,980. The next story is entitled, ISU Union Workers Rally for Contracts, Higher Pay. Dozens Share Wage Staffing Concerns at Demonstration, by Lenore Sabota. Normal. Union workers at Illinois State University and their supporters demonstrated Wednesday on a campus street corner, calling for fair contracts and fair pay. Locals 1110 and 3236 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, have been working under a contract that expired June 30th. The 2 locals represent more than 500 workers. "There haven't been any negotiation sessions since February," said Renee Nessler, an AFSCME Council 31 staff representative. ISU spokesman Eric Jome said, "The terms of the contract will continue in force while being renegotiated." The morning of the demonstration at College Avenue and School Street, agreement was reached to resume bargaining with Local 1110 in about 2 weeks. Jome said a meeting is scheduled to talk about details for Local 3236 health services workers next week. Even though there has been a gap in negotiation sessions, Jome said there has been ongoing correspondence. Local 1110 members include building service workers, grounds workers, and campus dining workers. Local 3236 includes clerical and library workers and healthcare providers in student health service. The size of the noon hour demonstration varied, with about 75 people at its peak. Wages are one of the current issues, said Nestler, adding, "We feel like, in some cases, the university does not respect the work our members do and doesn't give credit for the work they do to make the university work." But Jones said, "We value everyone's work, and the university is committed to being a fair and equitable workplace for all employees." Marcia Perry, a clerical worker in the College of Business and president of Local 3236, said one thing the union would like to see changed is a hiring range that has resulted in new hires coming in and making more than people who have been here 5 or 10 years. Cody Key, a building services worker who is president of Local 1110, said, "In addition to higher wages, I would like to see better staffing." Steve Fears, a Local 1110 member who works at the Bone Student Center, said he doesn't think a lot of people know what's going on, and the rally was a way to let them know the union situation. Fears, who has worked at ISU for 20 years, said, "It's a great place to work, but you have to stand up for what you believe in." The next article is headlined, "Lawyer: Zimmerman an Early Suspect. Ex-husband one of three men eyed after victim's body found," by Edith Brady Lunny and Kevin Barlow. Bloomington. Police considered Kirk Zimmerman a suspect in the shooting death of his ex-wife soon after her body was found, but other suspects were possible, his defense lawyer told a jury Wednesday. Zimmerman, 60, is accused of killing Pam Zimmerman, his wife of 20 years, before their 2012 divorce, in her East Side Bloomington office. She had been shot 4 times, and her body was found by a close friend and staff member on November 4, 2014. Defense lawyer John Rogers questioned Bloomington Police Sergeant Tim Power about the steps law enforcement officials took in the early stages of the investigation, including during 2 videotaped interviews police had with Zimmerman on November 4th and November 10th, 2014. Power acknowledged Zimmerman was a priority among three men for investigators' attention in the hours after the victim was found. Officers later talked with Eldon Whitlow, the victim's final client at her financial services office, and Scott Baldwin, her fiancé. On November 4th, hours after her body was found, Zimmerman was interviewed for 7 hours by 2 detectives. He asked repeatedly to see his children and was told they were at the Children's Advocacy Center, CAC. Power testified he was unaware that other officers told Zimmerman his children were at the police station. Rogers suggested Wednesday that police did not question Zimmerman at the CAC because you were treating him like a criminal suspect in a murder case. Power disagreed with that statement. Power acknowledged Zimmerman cooperated with police by coming to the police station 2 times for interviews. The defendant also provided a DNA sample and allowed an officer to swab his hands for gunshot residue after his initial hesitation to comply. Zimmerman's second visit to the police department, this time with a lawyer, came after he had been out of his home for 6 days while police searched it. His car, cell phone, and computers were seized. Following the November 4th interview, a Bloomington police officer dropped Zimmerman at a hotel, Rogers told jurors. During cross-examination, Rogers questioned Power about other possible suspects and asked if they received the same treatment as Zimmerman. Rogers pointed out that during the investigation, Zimmerman's financial records were heavily scrutinized, but the personal matters of other potential suspects, such as Baldwin and Whitlow, were not investigated. "You did not seek the credit card records for Whitlow or Baldwin, did you?" he asked. Power acknowledged that investigators did not seek those records. Rogers also questioned Power about the investigation into 2 other people with potential motives. Power acknowledged that investigators spoke with Dave Phillips, a man with whom Pam Zimmerman exchanged emails on a dating site, and Cynthia Conroy, a woman who was connected to Baldwin. Rogers suggested that Conroy would have had a motive for murder in an attempt to remove a romantic rival. Also testifying Wednesday were three Bloomington police detectives. Scott Mathewson testified about how police located the victim's cell phone and wallet several blocks from the crime scene. The phone was found in a pile of leaves near Felton Place and Robinson Street, and her wallet, which included her identification, was found a few blocks away on Robinson. Testimony continues Thursday afternoon. Here's an article entitled, Broman Rebuilds Therapy Gym. Simulated living area helps patients prepare to go home. By Paul Sweech. Normal. Teresa Prosser, Ashley Buldak, and Michael Vogel showed off a new kitchen, bedroom, bathroom, living room, laundry room, and front porch on Wednesday, and they did it without leaving Advocate Broman Medical Center. What they were showing off was not a new home, but a simulated home environment. Broman had an open house for its renovated and expanded acute rehabilitation unit therapy gym. It has been rebuilt into a simulated living environment in a $450,000 project designed to better prepare rehab patients for their transition back home. When patients leave here, they will feel more confident, said Prosser, Broman Director of Medical Surgical Services. We want them to be more comfortable transitioning to go home, said Buldak, an acute rehab services nurse. The acute rehab unit can serve up to 15 patients a day, and their average length of stay is 11 to 12 days, Prosser said. They include patients who have had a stroke or another neurological diagnosis, have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or congestive heart failure, or are rehabbing from trauma or orthopedic surgery. Patients get 3 hours of therapy a day, but physical, occupational, and speech therapy have been segmented, explained Vogel, therapy services manager. In this simulated home environment, we can work on all of these tasks together to make it more realistic, Vogel explained. It's not just about going to the gym, Vogel said. It's about functioning in your environment. The gym includes a functioning kitchen with a table, adaptive utensils to make gripping easier for stroke survivors, a lower counter so it can be used by patients using a wheelchair, cabinets, and a working stove, microwave, dishwasher, and refrigerator so patients can practice cooking and cleaning. The simulated home also includes a bedroom with a bed and closets, a bathroom, including a shower with grab bars and tub bench, a living room with a chair and couch, a laundry room with washer and dryer, and a front porch with doors, stairs, and a ramp. Patients will be able to use the simulated home environment as soon as it's approved for use by the Illinois Department of Public Health. As far as the new unit, I think it's the greatest thing that ever happened, former patient Dick Haas told the Pantograph. Haas, 79, of rural Leroy, was a patient in the acute rehab unit following surgery last September. He appreciated his care and therapy he had in the gym, but thinks the stimulated home environment makes it even better. It's so beneficial to the community, he said. And here's a story entitled, Veterans Hope More Join March. Heartland Group Plans Food Drive. By Lenore Sabota. Normal. Veterans attending Heartland Community College are looking for people to join them in carrying a ton of food to the Midwest Food Bank on Saturday. During their first Ruck March food drive last year, the Heartland Student Veterans of America collected 960 pounds and marched just over 6 miles from Heartland's Robb Road campus to Midwest Food Bank off Northtown Road, said Heartland sophomore Will Fouts, an Army veteran who heads the student group. About 50 people took part in last year's march. Fouts said Heartland students and veterans made up half the group, and the rest were community members, including students from Normal Community West High School. Fouts was honored with the Armed Forces Award at last year's American Red Cross Saluting Our Heroes breakfast for organizing the first march. This year, they are hoping to attract more participants by cutting the distance in half. walking 3.1 miles round trip from Rosa Parks Commons near the corner of Robb Road and Linden Street to Midwest Food Bank. "We hope to get about 100 people this time," said Fouts. They also set a goal of collecting 2,000 pounds of donations. Preferred donations include peanut butter, boxed meals, and canned goods, including soups and pasta. Donations can be dropped off in advance at Heartland at room 1101 of the Student Commons Building, or the atriums of the Instructional Commons Building, or the Workforce Development Center. People can also bring donations to the start of the march, even if they don't participate in the walk itself. The food drive was organized as a march because a ruck march is something we do in the military to move all our gear around, explained Fouts. "We're a veterans organization. This gives a little more meaning to the event." There will be food, inflatables, and games at Rosa Parks Commons after the march, he said. "We wanted to make it a day to bring the whole family out," said Fouts. The next story is entitled, "Cousins Subs Looks to Open in Twin Cities," by Derek Bay. Bloomington. Joe Ferguson hopes customers feel the industrial Midwest the moment they walk into a Cousins Subs. "We recently rolled out our interior design that's called Milwaukee Sub Shop and has a focus on industrial materials local to the Midwest and the Milwaukee area," said Ferguson, Vice President of Business Development for the Menominee Falls, Wisconsin-based chain. "We're a traditional sub shop from a sense of offering deli-fresh sandwiches, but the biggest thing that differentiates us is the grilled product, like cheesesteaks, plus fried cheese curds and shakes. We think it could be a great fit for Bloomington." The company is looking for a franchisee to bring Cousins to the Twin Cities and possibly Peoria and Springfield, as part of a wave of expansions that's brought the first Cousins to Chicago and will include another 40 stores in and around the Windy City. Ferguson envisions a new building near Eastland Mall with 15 to 25 employees and 35 to 50 seats, plus a drive-thru. Cousins stores are typically between 1,800 and 2,400 square feet. "We think it's naturally a contiguous market to the Chicago development, and Bloomington is really a natural way for us to go south to St. Louis," said Ferguson. "A typical Cousins order ranges from $8 to $12, depending on sides," he said. "Our standard subs range from $5.99 to $7.99 for our limited-time-only sandwiches," said Ferguson. "Those tend to be hearty and a little more creative. We've offered a Cubano and a Wisconsin steak with Johnsonville Brats." The chain also works with local communities, he said, including giving an annual college scholarship to a Wisconsin high school athlete, working with nearby schools, and participating in donation nights for community groups. "We're really coming off of a strong push to grow with our 40 stores in Chicago, and we feel it's the right time to grow Cousins throughout Illinois," Ferguson said. "We're excited for Bloomington to be part of that." Other local sub shops include Firehouse Subs, Jersey Mike's, Jimmy John's, Potbelly, and Subway. The chain is not associated with Cousins Family Restaurant at 921 Maple Hill Road in Bloomington, which reopened last year as Eric's 2. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Pantograph for April 11th. Please stay tuned.